by India. The rallies were held along with a host of events including conferences and seminars in attended by senior government officials and lawmakers in such major cities as Lahore, Karachi and Islamabad. Kashmir Solidarity Day is marked in Pakistan every year on February 5. The day marks the nation's renewed commitment to the people of Indian administered Kashmir. Participants in the rallies demanded the UN Security Council to implement its resolutions on Kashmiris' right to self-determination and end what they called the bloodshed in the Indian administered Jammu and Kashmir.
Observance of Solidarity Day on February 5 is proof of Pakistan's continued support for Kashmiris. We will never accept India's occupation of Jammu and Kashmir and will continue our struggle for the independence of the Kashmiri people.
The purpose of celebrating the day is to renew the pledge that the people of Pakistan will continue to provide moral, political and diplomatic support to their Kashmiri brothers and sisters until the independence of Indian-occupied Kashmir.
Kashmir, a Muslim-majority region, is divided into Indian and Pakistani sections, but claimed by both in full. The Kashmir dispute has led to several wars between the nuclear-armed rivals since Pakistan's independence in 1947.
The United Nations should play its role in ending the decades-long sufferings of Kashmiris who are struggling for their right to self-determination. The world should urge India to hold composite and meaningful dialogues with all the stakeholders to resolve the dispute.
Relations between India and Pakistan worsened in 2019 when the Indian government revoked Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, which granted Indian-administered Kashmir partial autonomy.
Islamabad has long argued that Kashmir should have acceded to Pakistan because of its Muslim majority population. However, the court response from India in this regard has put the matter on hold. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
South Korean families of the victims of the crowd crush that killed 159 mostly young people last Halloween gathered at the memorial in Itaewon on Saturday to mark 100 days since the tragedy. They demand a thorough independent probe and accountability.
We definitely need to know the reason why our children died here last October 29th. I think the only thing we can do for our sons and daughters who left this world for no reason is to hold those responsible and punish them.
Demonstrators marched from the memorial past the presidential office. 11 emergency calls were made in the hours before the disaster. Local officials knew tens of thousands would gather in Itaewon, but crowd control was not implemented. Still, the safety minister said the deaths could not have been prevented, angering family members. One investigation has led to a handful of indictments of police on duty and low-level officials, but top officials have been spared.
Naturally, it is the President, the Minister of the Interior and Safety, and the Commissioner of the National Police Agency who are obliged to take responsibility for the lives and safety of citizens. But from the beginning, right after the disaster, they sought to avoid responsibility, and politicians continue to insult the families and victims.
City Hall denied the marchers access to the nearby plaza for their demonstration, as the fallout from the tragedy turns ever more political. 26 foreigners died in the crowd crush last Halloween. Five of those were young Iranian exchange students. And as the families and their supporters seek justice, they face harassment and official indifference. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The political crisis deepens in Peru, where the legislative body has rejected President Dina Boluarte's bid to move elections to this year. Congress shelved the bill due to objections raised in a meeting of the Constitutional Committee on Friday. The matter is unlikely to be discussed before July when Congress begins its new session. Lawmakers had previously agreed to move the date of the elections from 2026 to April 2024, but it could not calm the protesters. Bularta thinks the reschedule of the voting to this year might help mitigate unrest and chaos. The South American country has been in the grip of unrest since early December. There have been frequent clashes between protesters and police in several cities, almost on a daily basis. Confrontations have resulted in dozens of deaths. Apart from early elections, Peruvian protesters also demand President Bularta step down.
We are outraged by the injustice that is happening, by the police repression, by the deaths, by the lack of justice, also because the people are demanding the resignation of the president.
However, Bularta has defied the calls accusing those demanding her resignation of pursuing political blackmail.
My resignation is not at stake in this situation. There is a minority of the population, of these groups that are generating violence and chaos in the country, who are pushing for my resignation in a blackmailing manner. And we are not going to give in to this political blackmail.
The protests have also taken a heavy toll on the country's economy, with workers being hit hard. The unrest has negatively affected the export of goods and the operation at key mines, which are major sources of income for the Andean nation. The protesters around the country have blocked highways, causing shortages of food, fuel, and other essentials in several regions. Hundreds of trucks remain stranded at the border with Bolivia, awaiting the end of a strike called by the protesters.
We are suffering every day. There's nothing to eat. Look how the roads are. You can't even walk, no motorcycle, no car, nothing. Dina Bularte's government do not pay attention to what the people are demanding. What more do they want? How many more deaths?
Peru's unrest has been propelled mainly by indigenous people from the south. That's where ousted President Pedro Castillo comes from. He was removed from office and arrested in early December as he was attempting to shutter Congress to stave off his impeachment. The demonstrators demand his release because they regard Castillo as the one who can fight poverty and inequality. It seems that the fundamental problems driving the unrest will not go away, as the protesters are not only angry over stark inequality, but they feel neglected by state institutions, especially Congress, which many Peruvians say are being run by corrupt lobbies and vested interests.
The recent decision by the European Central Bank to raise interest rates by a further 0.5% has thrown Italian families and small and medium entrepreneurs into the depths of gloom. Prices in Italy rose 8.1% year-on-year in 2022, hitting a 37-year high. Now, Italians see themselves stuck between a rock and a hard place. The country's inflation rate had shot up to around 12% in the months between October and December, a trend also seen across Europe. This is due to soaring energy and food prices linked primarily to the conflict in Ukraine and the related rearmament spending that all members of the bloc are engaged in. But it's also caused by the governments having thrown support packages worth hundreds of billions of euros at the corporations and the rich over the past years.
High inflation, soaring energy bills are biting hard. In addition to that, our average salaries have not kept up pace, and they have not gone up for years. It's really worrying.
Quite simply, I went to buy food at the supermarket last week and the items I usually buy for 30 euros cost me about 50 euros instead.
Although inflation rates have recorded a clear abatement across Europe, Italy is still dealing with two-digit inflation, which stands at over 10%.
The European Central Bank's latest rate hike has brought to 3% the total of interest rate increases over the past 6 months. The EU's governing council is expected to raise them further next month.
These moves by the ECB adopted to slow inflation don't seem to have worked very much so far. The problems affecting our economy seem to be rather structural, and this situation has led citizens and businesses to lose confidence in a real recovery.
According to a survey of some 27,000 citizens commissioned by the European Parliament, More than 9 out of 10 of Europeans are very concerned about the rising cost of living. 40% of the people living in the EU feel they are already struggling to pay for food and other basics, and almost 1 in 2 says the standard of living has fallen. But more worryingly, they are not holding out much hope for the future, either, as another 39% expect the standard of living to fall this year. Max Civili, Rome.
The 53rd exhibition of Iran's nuclear industry achievements was inaugurated in Tehran on Thursday. The event showcases the latest nuclear products made in Iran. Attended by head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, the expo put on display different applications of the nuclear sector, from centrifuges to radiopharmaceuticals and particle accelerators.
Despite all external pressures, we have managed to advance our nuclear sector, and this expo shows a small part of it. Today, we have become self-sufficient in nuclear fuel, radio medicine, and many other fields such as heavy water.
In recent years, Iran has been trying to diversify the applications of its nuclear sector. Besides power generation, the country is now focusing on particle accelerators for food irradiation and radiotherapy.
Irradiation systems are being built in Iran on a national scale. This will allow the country to irradiate all its food and agricultural products. This way, we can reduce food waste, ensure food security for our people, and enhance our agricultural exports.
Since Iran indigenized its nuclear industry in 2006, it has constantly been targeted by sanctions over what the West calls fears of a nuclear bomb, something which Tehran categorically rejects, saying its nuclear program is civilian and peaceful.
As you know, the West has long been leading a psychological campaign against Iran's nuclear activity, accusing Iran of pursuing non-peaceful purposes. So we hold this exhibition for our people to see for themselves that our nuclear program is peaceful.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reinstatement of sanctions against Tehran in 2018, Iran took retaliatory steps by scaling back its commitments to the pact. The Vienna discussions between Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal, which aimed to revive the accord, have remained stalled since August last year. This, as Tehran says, it will come back to full compliance only if Washington removes all its sanctions.
By displaying these nuclear products, Iran tries to show the West that sanctions cannot disrupt its nuclear program. At the same time, the AEOI says it will continue to build up the country's nuclear industry even beyond the JCPOA limits, if sanctions are not removed. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Black Lives Matter. This is a popular slogan we often come across in the streets of the United States following the fatal shooting and beating to death of African Americans there. That began with the racially motivated killing of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, among others. Anger and shock once again prevail as American protesters march their cities to denounce police brutalities and demand justice for another victim, 29-year-old Tyre Nichols. The man was beaten to death by a group of officers in the city of Memphis, Tennessee, after he was stopped for a traffic violation in early January. Nichols was in confusion as to why he had been stopped, but before he could know, the cops started kicking, punching, and pepper spraying him while he was crying for help. Nichols was pronounced dead in a hospital 3 days later. Activists are still in disbelief on how the police could treat a member of the society like Nichols as an enemy in the battlefield.
Here I am now in 2023, and I'm looking at another video, this in color, where I'm seeing another black man being beat to death. Rodney didn't die. This is worse. It's beat to death with no mercy on no crime that they can even find that he had committed.
Here at Nichols' funeral, his family desperately called for an end to police brutality against the African-American community. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, who was also present at the funeral, slammed the killing and talked about an act that has a slim chance of getting passed in the Congress. Ironically, U.S. officials have turned up on such occasions in the past and made similar promises, but to no avail. Figures show that police brutality remained as rampant as it had been in the previous years. Law enforcement killed nearly 1,200 people, or about 100 people a month last year, making it the deadliest for police violence. Repeated shooting and lack of transparency have already terrorized America's black community. Many believe the reoccurrence of the brutal scene cannot be prevented by just suspending culprits. No African American will truly become safe from police brutality until its root causes are identified and dealt with.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad, and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's a once-in-a-century disaster that is gut-wrenching to surely make any human shiver due to the depth of the calamity, an earthquake that has taken away so many lives in two countries, Turkey and Syria. Devastation and deaths have occurred in both of those countries, yet one country is receiving more attention and aid, Turkey over Syria. Aren't they both a victim of this natural disaster? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at this angle of this horrible incident and why the U.S. and some of its allies, like Israel, have offered to help Syria, even though they have been responsible for the previous devastation through their war on Syria, not to mention sanctions. This is while Israel has continued to bomb Syria.
Search and rescue efforts are underway in Turkey and Syria after two massive earthquakes rattled large swathes of the two neighboring countries and left thousands dead. Rescuers are digging through piles of the rubble to find possible survivors. But the freezing weather conditions is not only hampering rescue operations, but adding misery to those who left injured or homeless. Concerns are particularly high over the situation in Syria. The natural disaster has multiple tragedies Syrians have been going through for over a decade. The devastating quake brings to the spotlight how difficult life has been for millions of those who were displaced by foreign-backed militancy and endured Western sanctions. The crippling curbs have devastated Syria's economy to the extent that the country is unable to recover and reconstruct by its own. Now the same unlawful sanctions are complicating international efforts to assist Syrians who have been affected by the latest quakes. The World Health Organization says Syria's humanitarian needs are the highest, describing the situation as a crisis on top of multiple crises.
WHO recognizes Turkey's strong capacity to respond and considers that the main unmet needs maybe in Syria in the immediate and midterm.
That assessment is echoed by other UN officials as well as rescue workers on the ground in northern Syria.
Those people already needed assistance. Now they will need more of that assistance, and they need an immediate earthquake-related assistance.
Honestly, the situation is very disastrous. It needs the interference of United Nations organizations and international organizations that are specialized in rescuing, because the situation is very harsh and people are still under the rubble from yesterday.
British activist Vanessa Bealey, who is now in Syria, says the Western sanctions could target anybody who comes to Syria's assistance.
The people who are now homeless are in the streets soaking wet and freezing cold without any alternative shelter and without any electricity, without any heating, without any fuel, because of course we don't have any heating fuel either in the country pretty much. So these shortages combined of course with the Western barbaric sanctions, including the CISA law that was imposed by the Trump administration, which penalizes any country that even comes to the assistance of Syria. So those countries that can then be sanctioned by default if they come to the aid of Syria, which is, you know, a criminal sanctions regime to impose on any country and quite unprecedented.
Now the Syrian Red Crescent has appealed to Western countries to lift sanctions and provide aid to help the Arab country deal with the aftermath of the devastating earthquakes. The humanitarian organization has also urged the United Nations to facilitate the aid effort, particularly in the militants-held area in northwestern Syria. It says they are ready to deliver relief to those areas if militants open a road for them. The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies said a quick hit areas may need years to recover from the destruction. It says long-term help will be needed and not just assistance in search and rescue operation for survivors.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Elijah Magnier is a journalist and political analyst who joins us from Brussels. Also joining us, Edward Horgan, peace activist and former UN peacekeeper, who joins us from Limerick over in Ireland. Gentlemen, welcome. Elijah Magnier, I will start with you. And this is quite a bit of stat in terms of the message it sends, and I'm wondering why this is the way it is. And that's concerning foreign aid, where you have 5,000 deaths, or maybe over that amount at this point, that have died because of the devastating earthquakes in both countries, Turkey and Syria, 3,000 in Turkey, roughly, and 2,000 in Syria. And then you have 65 countries who have pledged aid for Turkey, yet five countries for Syria. What do you think the story is there?
Thank you for having me. Syria has been since many years, even before the beginning of the war in 2011. And with the Caesar Act that was imposed unilaterally and unlawfully by the US and the EU to cripple the population, in theory, should not include the humanitarian aid. However, as we have seen the case with Cuba, with Iran, with Syria, Venezuela, particularly during the COVID-19 and much before, where humanitarian aids are not excluded from the sanctions that are imposed by the US and the EU. Moreover, there are no countries around the world that dare to challenge the US by sending their plane to Damascus, except a few, like Iran sent 40 to 45 tons of support. Iraq is doing the same. Emirati will send some more. Algeria, Tunisia, and many other countries promised to send support to Syria. However, by seeing 74 nations supporting Turkey and only 5 to 7 countries sending their humanitarian support is something fundamentally wrong, because according to the UN Charter, there are no differences between an enemy or a friend when it comes to natural disaster. So when we see the fake, the hypocrisy, and the double standard of the West talking about human rights, generally speaking, but their behavior in Syria when they see only what's happening in Turkey and try to close an eye about what's happening in Syria is unacceptable, because there are thousands of people under the debris. Syria is not capable of supporting these people in this case of natural disaster. Throughout the war, there were 38 hospitals that were destroyed. 700 doctors have been killed by the jihadists and all the allies of the West that have interfered in Syria. And also the United Nations is not moving. The international international organizations are not encouraging each other to go to Syria and support the population as they are doing rightly in Turkey. But as you said, there are plus 2,000 people under the debris killed in Syria, and there are much more still when the Syrian government is unable to reach them. There are mass graves that are created on the spot in many villages in Syria in the north, close to Gaziantep. And all this is a catastrophic disaster that humanity is really closing an eye or turning the head and looking the other way.
Well, let me ask you what you think, Edward Horgan, about what the U.S. has said. When it comes to Turkey, the U.S. has said it can count on it for anything that it needs in the aftermath of this quake. In terms of Syria, this is what the U.S. has said. Ned Price, quote, "It would be quite ironic, if not even counterproductive, for us to reach out to a government that has brutalized its people over the course of a dozen years. This is a regime that has never shown any inclination to put the welfare, the well-being, the interests of its people first." I've noticed plenty of scenes, as I'm sure you have, and I'm sure that government spokesperson has seen, including U.S. officials, of children under the rubble in Syria being pulled out, and many to have ended up in hospital beds that have died later on. And yet they come out and they make this type of statement. What do you think about their stance regarding this?
Yeah, I think it's very hypocritical of the U.S., considering what the U.S. and its allies did in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Iraq, and in Syria and Yemen. The sanctions in particular are being imposed primarily by the U.S. and the European Union. Sanctions imposed in circumstances like this kill people. I would call immediately for all sanctions on Syria to be removed and for all countries to give as much aid as possible to Turkey and a similar amount to Syria. I visited Aleppo with an Irish peace group in 2017. I saw the devastation that had been caused in Aleppo then. Clearly, a large area of northwestern Syria had been very severely damaged, and humanitarian emergency needs to be addressed. So very clearly, the sanctions imposed by the US, European Union and others are now causing very severe damage. Also, the US is at the moment in illegal occupation of part of northeastern Syria. It has at least 900 troops. Likewise, Turkey is also illegally occupying part of northwestern Syria. These countries shouldn't be interfering directly in Syria. And now, in the middle of this crisis, it's vital that a huge amount of humanitarian effort is needed, not only in Turkey, but equally in Syria.
The war on Syria that has lasted, even to this day, really, in a sense, Elijah Magnier, needs to be put into perspective when it comes to the way that it's dealing with this devastation through the earthquake and what it has done. And one personal recount here is how a Syrian was found dead in his bed. This is a person that's recounting this. A Syrian was found dead in his bed this past winter because he had no heating. Why? Because U.S. sanctions are hurting ordinary people rather than Bashar al-Assad's government, because there's only an hour or so of electricity per day. This war has reduced this country to such a low level of infrastructure capacity that it's dealing with this type of situation. Surely, when this earthquake hit, as we're speaking, there are patients arriving at the hospitals that don't have the machinery, nor the equipment, nor the medicine, because of sanctions, and also because of the war devastation, to deal with people. Again, these are all knock-on effects, which ultimately leads to people dying. Isn't that one way of looking at what has happened to Syria in the lens of this earthquake?
Yes.
Well, we know from...
This is for Elijah Magnier. I'm sorry, Edward. I'll get to you in a minute. Go ahead, Elijah.
We know from President Joe Biden himself, when he said sanctions are not made to change the government, they made to attack the well-being of the population. Such a statement made by Joe Biden directed to Russia can be directed to Cuba, to Iran, 43 years under sanctions, to Venezuela, to Syria, to Lebanon, to the Palestinians. All these people who have been under harsh U.S. sanctions because they don't accept the U.S. terms and they do not submit to the U.S. hegemony, according to the U.S. understanding of human rights, the U.S. is not looking after the population. On the contrary, it's seriously contributing in the killing of the population. When there is 1 hour of electricity in Syria, 2 hours in Lebanon, it's because in Syria, it's only Iran is feeding the country with oil, while the Americans are stealing the oil in the north. And I'm not inventing anything. It's President Donald Trump who said, I want to take the Syrian oil. And then Joe Biden just followed exactly the same policy as Donald Trump, which means that the objective is to cripple the Syrian government, to cripple the Syrian population, to starve the Syrian population, exactly what they are doing in Yemen too. And they really don't care. The end result for them is all justified. These people submit their lure, or they have to suffer. This is what Mike Pompeo said about the Iranian. They want to eat, they have to come to the U.S. So what's happening in Syria is that been going on for the last 3-4 years. And that, if we don't count all the years of war that was waged against the Syrian government to create a failed state and allow the jihadists to take over the country, because for the U.S. and the West and NATO, the jihadists are more preferable to be in the Levant rather than President Assad and the Syrian who voted for the president. So it is obvious that the West is watching the Syrian dying, and they really can't be careless about it, because their objective is completely different, is not related to the human right, and is not related to the well-being of the population.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Edward Horgan, when you take a look at, first of all, why is Syria still under sanctions? Isn't that war supposed to be over in a sense? I mean, what is the U.S. trying to achieve when it has already done what it did a few years back, the most severe sanctions being the Caesar Act that it leveled against the country, which means nobody can get close to the country to do any type of trade? That's not even working. You even have U.S. allies who are now back in the game with Syria and the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, like the UAE, like even the Arab League that's opening itself up, like Jordan, and other Arab countries that are possibly in the works to get back together with Syria again. So that puts into question what the U.S. is after.
Yes, the sanctions are having the most devastating effect, in particular on the most vulnerable people, the children and the elderly and those who are already ill. So it's vital that the sanctions be removed as quickly as possible, and that as much aid is sent into Syria, into all parts of Syria. Probably the largest area affected is both the city and the province of Aleppo, and areas controlled by the Syrian government. And it's very likely that the sanctions will prevent much of the aid from getting to the people who need it most. Sanctions kill people, and especially in Syria, and many more people will die because of the sanctions, in addition to the devastation that has been caused by the earthquakes. So it's vital that the sanctions be removed as quickly as possible. Also, only the United Nations should be allowed to impose sanctions. Arguably, the sanctions imposed by the US and the European Union are in contravention of international law because of the damage they are causing and the people they are killing.
There's a provision that the UN has that I'm almost sure that you're familiar with this, Elijah Magnier. It's called R2P, the right to protect. And that was what NATO used, in essence, when it attacked Libya, because it accused the Libyan government pretty much violating the rights of the people of Libya. And that was the basis, which we saw how that turned out. Now, is it correct to analyze and then compare that being law by the UN for there to be a motion towards what is happening now to remove these harsh sanctions, which are in essence killing Syrians? And now we're seeing that a natural disaster like an earthquake has compounded the deaths of people. In a sense, it's just like what the R2P sounds like, the right to protect. The Syrians need that. Can there be any motion towards that on the international arena?
Yeah, and then when NATO, when the United Nations agreed on the resolution, it was very specifically stating that it is to the protection of the civilians. The problem is the United Nations can issue any law or any resolution, but then it is interpreted completely differently by the people and the countries who want to wage war and want to change and interpret the resolution in the way they want. And this is what happened in Libya. So we have to really look carefully and not overestimate what the United Nations resolutions are, because in the matter of Palestine, there are 178 resolutions that have never been respected. Therefore, the United Nations is no longer a viable body, international body that is respected. It is just a building with so many employees. But at the end of the day, who is falling back to the United Nations? The war in Iraq was not agreed by the United Nations and was against the United Nations. It was an illegal war. The sanctions against Syria are unilateral sanctions by the EU and the US. The sanction against Iran is only US sanctions, but who dares to violate these sanctions without the fear of paying the price and then be also sanctioned by the US? So it's a jungle law. We don't have a United Nations. We should really forget about what the United Nations are capable of, because they're not capable of anything. They are under the control of the West. And when the West is opposed by other superpower nations like Russia and China, then the revolution don't go forward. And then they go to war anyway, and they do whatever they want, and they don't care about the United Nations. So we don't have to look at this international body as a balancing the world and then looking really to the well-being of the nations and where the nations have a say. There is a bully of the world called the United States of America, and is saying, I do things my way, and if you don't accept, you will be sanctioned. This is exactly what Donald Trump said to the German and to the European allies when they refused to follow his policy.
Thank you very much. We're fresh out of time. Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Edward Horgan, peace activist and former UN peacekeeper from Limerick, Ireland. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you.
IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
Exxon hoarded $56 billion in profits last year, crushing the previous record for profits set by a Western oil company. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, riding on the wave of sky-high gas prices and industry-wide price hikes, oil giant Exxon was handed the highest profits ever reported by a Western oil company in 2022, its latest financial report reveals. The company reported recently that it made a net profit of $55.7 billion in 2022, roughly 2.5 times its 2021 profits of $23.6 billion. This represents $6.3 million in profits per hour on average last year, Reuters pointed out. This doesn't just break the record for yearly profits for a Western oil company. It completely crushes the previous record. Last year's profits surpassed the previous high set by Exxon in 2008 by over $10 billion. Exxon's profits come at the expense of the public, not just because of the literal expenses at the gas pump, but also because of the company's role in advancing and denying the existence of the climate crisis with its fossil fuel products, which are steadily eroding the livability of the planet. Fossil-free media director Jamie Henn said that Exxon's profits are especially egregious when put in context with the role in helping oil and gas industry to be a larger player in the world's energy market, which combined with the country's crisis that has also played a part in causing gas prices to soar. Henn told Truthout via email, "This year's profits are really beyond the pale. Exxon's profits are particularly galling because they are profiting off a crisis they helped create. Exxon worked with people for decades to expand oil and gas production so much so that this company awarded Exxon's former CEO Rex Tillerson a Medal of Friendship. Add to that the report that came out this month about how back in 1970s Exxon predicted with pinpoint accuracy the climate catastrophe we are now experiencing, and you start to see exactly what a criminal enterprise this company is engaged in," Henn continued, adding, "it's robbery on a planetary scale."
Other oil giants also posted extreme increases in their profits last year, gathered in large part due to soaring gas prices that drained Americans' wallets, as they were also hit by inflation in nearly every other sector. Marathon Petroleum and Phillips 66 posted profits totaling nearly $25 billion, with Marathon enjoying a 46% year-over-year increase, with Phillips multiply its 2021 profits by 3.5 times. Altogether, the three oil majors that posted profits recently raked in over $82.5 billion in profits in 2022, in large part off the backs of the public. The companies also revealed in earnings calls that they had spent $46.6 billion on stock buybacks and dividends in 2022, PayAccountable.us, handing piles of cash to their shareholders and executives as the working class suffered a lot. Chevron also reported record profits in its quarterly report posted recently, which showed that the company doubled its profits last year, gathering $36.5 billion in profits. The company also announced last week that it is tripling its stock buyback program to an eye-popping $75 billion, one of the largest stock buyback plans ever carried out. These profits came as a result of oil and gas companies' decades-long strategies to deny the existence of the climate crisis and delay action to draw down fossil fuels. Oil and gas companies have known internally for decades that reliance on fossil fuel would cause major climate destruction, threatening millions, if not billions, of human lives, but have spent decades covering it up and persuading politicians to let them continue the industry's grip on the global energy market. Climate advocates like Hen have called for a windfall tax on big oil in response to what they say is price gouging. They say that such a tax would discourage oil companies from arbitrarily inflating prices while putting money back in the pockets of the public. Big oil has imposed a private tax on the American people to the tune of more than $90 billion from just two companies alone, said Public Citizen President Robert Weisman in a statement, adding, "This industry is out of control. Big oil is price gouging us to record profits while destroying the ability of future generations to live on our planet." Meanwhile, consumers spent last year paying high prices to put fuel in their cars and are spending more to heat and power their homes this winter. Last fall, President Biden threatened oil companies with a windfall tax to capture their excess profits if gas prices continue to stay high, as they had nearly all year. Gas prices did indeed decrease slightly then, but started rising again this month and could continue surging to over $4 a gallon by this spring, analysts predict. These prices increases are happening alongside Republican moves to even further limit the government's ability to ease gas prices, as the party has taken over control of the House. Meanwhile, Arab News wrote in this regard, Exxon said it incurred a $1.3 billion hit to its fourth quarter earnings from EU windfall tax that began in the final quarter and from asset impairments. The company is suing the EU, arguing that the levy exceeds its legal authority. Excluding charges, profit for the full year was $59.1 billion. Production was up by about 100,000 barrels of oil and gas per day over a year ago to 3.8 million BPD. Adjusted per share profits of $3.40 beat consensus of $3.29 per share, according to Refinitiv data. Shares were up about 1% at $114.70. It's a headline beat. Biraj Borkataria from RBC Capital said in a note, despite lower chemical margins, lower than expected downstream gains and plans for higher maintenance works in refineries this quarter.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.